Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
The 1960s gave birth to many fringe groups and movements, including spiritual groups, and an underground culture that encompassed drug use, civil disobedience, and a lack of sexual inhibitions. While many young people emerged from this period as healthy, successful adults, some of them were drawn deeper into counterculture lifestyles. One group of extremists were the Manson family. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Cult Following. I'm Todd Fisher, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Katie. Hi, Dr. Katie.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
Great. Well, we have gotten episode one going here. Can you believe it?
Yay, I'm so excited. I know, finally. Well, I think it's going to be a really, really good one and interesting, very interesting.
For sure. You know, we've recorded an episode zero, which was our introduction to kind of what people could expect from this limited series podcast, but now we're actually getting into the meat of the very first one. And like, we've been talking about this for like a year, this idea.
We have, yes. And so it's been a lot of work on the front end and figuring out what we want to do and talk about and the different cults that we want to look into and really bringing this a different aspect to this idea of cults and their leaders and looking at the psychology behind that. I think it'll make for a really good podcast.
That's really the most interesting factor to me is, you know, the people. It comes down to the leader and the followers. It usually these cults, they generally end badly, you know. And what always fascinated me was, you know, I think most people hear the story of how cults end, but I find the interest in how they begin and particularly how the people kind of grow to make those, both on a leader and a follower perspective. And I think we're really going to see a lot of that in today's episode with the Manson family, because, you know, Charles Manson was actually, he had such a traumatic childhood, and that is in no way any kind of defense for him in terms of, you know, what he created and how his destructive cult ended. But it's really interesting as we dug into the members of the family and Charles himself, what we found. Do you agree with that? I think that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I think it really is too. And so as a psychologist, I mean, this is one of the things that I look at a lot with people, right? What happened growing up? What possibly is related to how we turn out as people, as adults, functioning in society, these cultures, these countercultures or subcultures that pop up, like these cults that we're going to talk about. And even though we always think about Charles Manson, as far as the public's view of him as somebody who was, you know, very awful, did awful things. And of course he did, like you said, but he was also a person. And so there's a lot of complexity behind that. And what happened leading up to, you know, the Manson family cult as a whole. So I'm really looking forward to diving into this one.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of kick this off with the events of what happened with the Manson family. Now, there's already a ton of information out there. So this podcast is not about the crimes of the Manson family. If that's what you're looking for, there's other podcasts and other documentaries and other things out there that are going to be way more thorough than we're going to get into here, because again, our perspective isn't necessarily about the events at the end of the Manson family cult. Is more about how it was built, what made it up. But I am going to give people kind of a brief overview of how this all came to be. So Charles Manson founded a group he called The Family in San Francisco in 1967. And they were just one of many communes that sprung up across the country during the 60s. At that time, Manson had already become a convicted felon and had served jail time before ever even creating his group of followers. He used sex and he used drugs to seduce lonely, isolated young people into his circle of followers. And he really like had any kind of he really barely had any kind of semblance of a theology. There is some that's there we're going to get into, but the family did quickly become a cult. And we're going to get into really how all these people came to be and how they met and all that as we get a little further in. The Manson family is one of those rare cases of a non-religious cult in the U.S. And
that's an interesting part of this to me too, because I think, well, at least for me, before we started diving deeper into a lot of these cults, that was one of the things that I thought about when someone talked about a cult, right? I automatically thought about some religious aspect to that.
Yeah.
So this should be interesting to look at.
It's technically a destructive cult is what it is. Mm-hmm. And Manson had all of these erotic beliefs, drew upon different ideologies that he came across, Scientology, Satanism, other esoteric teachings. And he and Charles Manson's big thing was he prophesied that America would fall into a race war, which he called Helter Skelter, which was named after a popular Beatles song. And he said what would happen was this war would be won by African Americans, but they would soon turn to white people for leadership. And it was Manson's intention to hide during this war, only emerging later to assume leadership over whoever was victorious, which is really interesting. That's actually sort of a little bit disputed that there was ever really a race war. There's many people in criminology that think that was just kind of like a red herring to disguise something else he was doing, but that's still become part of the popular telling of the Manson family story of what Helter Skelter was supposed to be. And what happened was Manson became impatient for his prophecy to be fulfilled. So he ordered his followers to commit a series of murders, framing African Americans for the crime. So he wanted to actually ignite this himself. So over the course of 2 days, 9 people were murdered, including the coffee heiress Abigail Folger, the actress Sharon Tate, who was the pregnant wife of Hollywood director Roman Polanski. And that's that crime spree, that murder spree, is what the public really knows about the Manson family. That's been made into movies and documentaries and all kinds of stuff. And let's, you know, that's the legacy of these murders. Let's get into that a little bit. Like, I know you're a little bit of a true crime junkie yourself, Dr. Katie. Is that the fascination here? we talked off mic earlier in the day as we were preparing for this about whether these murders, if anyone would have cared if they were just average people, or whether the crimes weren't as brutal. What do you think about that? Is part of the legacy of this that it was a famous actress and that she was pregnant and it was done in such a brutal nature?
Yeah, I think this is a really a cool, well, I don't know if cool is the right word, but a good debate to have or internal kind of just going back and forth between, you know, would this have mattered as much if Sharon Tate hadn't been involved, if it hadn't been so horrible and that she was very pregnant. I mean, again, not to invalidate anyone else that was killed or harmed by this, but I'm thinking as far as how we see this as society and the popularization of the Manson legacy, so to speak, I don't know that would have happened to the extent that we continue to see it today if Sharon Tate had not been involved and there hadn't have been this this Hollywood aspect to these murders and to this cult in and of itself. I mean, honestly, we'll see this throughout, is that Hollywood kind of ran through this storyline, even just through Charles Manson on some level. And so for me, I don't know. I mean, obviously it's hard to say, but I think it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be as big as it became if Sharon Tate hadn't have been involved. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's some interesting dynamics at work here. And I often wonder, you know, Manson, and we're going to get to his conviction later in the podcast, but he was actually initially given a death sentence, and then California did away with the death sentence. So he wound up living in prison for a very, very long time. And in a way, Manson was protected. I mean, he was a hero to a lot of people in prison. He was a basically untouchable, a godlike figure in the prison system. Unlike a child molester that goes in the prison system, or, you know, like the some of these people that are immediately get prison justice and are beaten to death, you know, like right. Manson was very much a celebrity till the day he died from that a dark culture perspective. And I often wonder, you know, would this man have just been tried as a murderer and we would have forgotten about him, just like we would forget about, you know, someone who murdered someone in Kentucky? You know, they're off in the prison system. We never knew who they were to begin with, and it was over. Or did his celebrity increase even more as a result of murdering a celebrity? Because certainly he is synonymous with Sharon Tate. You cannot separate the two.
Yes.
When you discuss Manson, you're discussing Tate. And, you know, movies are still being made about this stuff. And this shows no sign of ever going away. It's still 50 years later, over 50 years later now, and still in our culture as something people are still writing about it, telling stories about. Mm-hmm. So what happened here exactly? Did the public make this fascination? Did Hollywood make this fascination with him? Was there, did Manson become more epically popular as a result of this being a Hollywood slaying? Did they make him? Did Hollywood make him? Like, is you see what I mean? How interesting it is to kind of think about.
Yeah, it is. I know, to like have a self, almost an internal debate, because I'm going back and forth between those ideas as well when I think about it. I just think it wouldn't have been nearly as sensationalized if Sharon Tate hadn't have been involved. And I'm sure her family doesn't love that they're synonymous, like you say, to this day still, but I really think that spurred him into this kind of higher level of celebrity that we would not have necessarily seen otherwise.
Yeah,
I believe that.
The gory nature of these murders became a national sensation. There's no debating that.
It did. Yep.
And investigators quickly found Charles Manson. They arrested him and several of his followers, and he was convicted and sentenced to death. But California, as I said, banned the death penalty, so he spent the rest of his life in prison. And some of Manson's followers actually remained faithful to him throughout his trial and his incarceration. And to this, obviously Manson's dead now, and almost all his followers are, but there are still people that are still loyal to Charles Manson. There are still people that try to carry on his ideology. So it's really a fascinating thing. And I often wonder, you know, is it healthy for American media, worldwide media, you know, authors, storytellers? I mean, can this just be put to bed? Why does this keep coming up? It's not like anyone's, this isn't like a documentary on, you know, what not to do, you know, how things go. Like, no one ever does it like that. It's almost just true crime stories for the sake of telling true crime stories as entertainment.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I would say really polarizing figures like this, it seems like we tend to keep them around, keep them alive on either end of the spectrum. And so I think with Manson, like you said, we're still seeing movies come out based on this storyline and books. And I mean, people still talk about this to this day. So I don't see it going anywhere anytime soon. Again, I think people are fascinated by how did this happen? How did this come about? Which is why I think, you know, this podcast is going to be so interesting, because we're really going to delve into the psychological aspects of the family members and Manson and the situation of cults as a whole, and see how they could have possibly developed.
I'm going to move the narrative backwards a little bit and talk about the family some and kind of where they were at. And then we're going to get into the individuals, starting with Charles Manson and then through his more well-known followers. Manson established himself as a guru in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district during kind of the Summer of Love era. Manson kind of borrowed his philosophy from the Process Church of the Final Judgment, whose members believed that Satan would become reconciled to Christ and they would come together at the end of the world to judge humanity. So this was technically a satanic church. this was an influence on him in his San Francisco days. So I, you know, right out of the gate, you know, you're not having that's not going to be a great influence on what your mindset is. And when we get into talking about Charles, we're going to hear about how traumatic his childhood was. So we already have a very damaged individual that's getting to San Francisco in the middle of the big hippie movement, where drugs are involved, free love is involved. And then your influence, well, at least one of your influences becomes a satanic church, but it starts to seed what will become his ideology. Manson soon found his first group of followers in San Francisco and coined the phrase the Manson family, and that's what they would become. Most of these people were female. Manson taught his followers that they were kind of the reincarnation of the original Christians, and that the Romans were the establishment, the government, and he strongly implied that he was Christ. And he often told a story of envisioning himself on the cross with nails in his feet and in his hands. He would present himself as a Christ-like figure, and many of his followers looked at him that way and considered him that too. And I think that's really interesting. The odd part about what happened in San Francisco was when Charles Manson actually moved to San Francisco, he actually moved in with someone he knew there. And it didn't take long before, you know, they couldn't pay their rent and they were evicted. And that is the reason he leaves San Francisco to go to Southern California to the Spahn Ranch, which is really how most people know of the Manson family, on this old movie studio backlot ranch. So Manson establishes a base for the family at the Spahn Ranch in August of 1968, after he's been evicted. And this was an old television and movie set for Westerns, but the buildings had deteriorated, Westerns weren't as popular, and the ranch's revenue was primarily derived from selling horseback rides. Female family members, Manson family members, did chores around the ranch, and they occasionally had sex on Manson's orders with the nearly blind 80-year-old owner, George Spahn. The women also acted as kind of his seeing eye guides, in exchange for all this, Spahn allowed Manson and his group to live at the ranch for free. So that's how he gets to the ranch and how he really starts to establish his commune. The group consisted of around 50 followers. Yeah. They all kind of lived that unconventional hippie lifestyle. They were habitual drug users using hallucinogenic drugs such as LSD. Most were young women from middle-class backgrounds, many of whom were radicalized by Manson's teachings and also drawn by kind of the hippie culture and the communal living aspect of what he was building there. And at that remote ranch where they were isolated from any other influences, Manson's was the only opinion heard, which I think is really interesting and part of his brainwashing technique that he would use. At every meal, he would lecture repetitively to people. Manson decided when they would eat, when they would sleep, when they would have sex, with whom they'd have sex with. He also controlled the taking of LSD, giving followers larger doses than he himself would actually take. And according to Manson, he would say, and this is a quote, when you take LSD enough times, you reach a state of nothing, of no thought. And that was his goal. He wanted to get people to a zombie-like state in which they would do whatever he would ask. What do you think about that?
I think, I was thinking this as you were going along. I really think we start to see, well, one, that intense level of grandiosity, comparing himself to Christ and, you know, seeing himself on the cross and other people referring to him as being Christ-like, a lot of grandiosity there. I also see a lot of manipulation there, just even now at the very beginning of this. So manipulating the other female family members and manipulating even the gentleman that was letting them use the ranch, right? Because he kind of is relying on them at this point now, because he can't really see, you know, he's getting to have sex with these women. And so he becomes reliant as well on Manson. And so Manson is really setting this up, in my mind, setting these people up to have to rely on him in more ways than one. So mentally and physically. And I just really see that manipulation starting to take hold and take root here.
He definitely created an intense system of control he really controlled a lot. He kind of, in a way, controlled the ranch by helping out George Spahn. And he certainly had a system of control with his people in terms of kind of dictating everything that happened there. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, you show up at a commune, like communes exist today. People can still go to communes. They're still all over the world. And, you know, it's not like you show up one day and it's like a prison where everything is like super strict. You just kind of fall into it over time. You kind of like the idea of the communal living, and you're outside the law and you're living off the grid, and you're, you know, you feel this rebellious thing inside you, you know, that you're proud of. And then before you know it, you're kind of succumbing to a rule here and a rule there and a rule there and a rule there. And he becomes the establishment. What he hated, he actually has become when enforcing this system of rules.
That's a really good point. I also see this, I am really seeing this exploitation of the hippie movement, right? So free love, he's kind of exploiting that, this idea of sexual freedom, through using sex as a tool in these early days, even, and drugs too. I see him as using that more as a tool. Like, maybe he does really enjoy the effects of LSD and, you know, believes that it's okay to take, obviously. But I do think we can see that in where he's giving larger doses to the other members than himself. Like you said, he wants to remain in control. So I'm seeing that exploitation of these ideas that maybe brought these women out there in the first place. And he's kind of manipulating those a little bit in a way that maybe these people weren't able to see at first.
And it's interesting because I think if you aren't making money and you need a place to crash, you're willing to accept a certain amount of rules because you're being given some kind of charity to be able to live in these old buildings on the ranch. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear even today if any of these Manson family members actually had jobs other than, you know, horseback riding lessons and things like this. Like, we're not really sure where the money was made. I don't think there's any clear consensus of whether they were dealing any drugs. They were just consumers of drugs. Like, no one's really clear how they made the money to even survive or eat on the ranch. But the point is at least on some level, people are receiving some kind of charity by Manson allowing them to live there. So that's without any drugs, right? So you're already going to maybe succumb to an influence in a way, but once the drugs enter the picture, I think that allows for an even bigger amount of control on the part of Manson.
Yes, I agree completely. Especially, you know, psychedelic drugs that have a lot of effects on your consciousness. And giving you that altered state of consciousness.
Yeah. I'm going to get into young Manson here for a second. So, you know, Dr. Katie and I were from the Midwest, and Dr. Katie in particular from Kentucky.
We are.
So we gives you a connection to Charles Manson, who was born in Kentucky. Yeah.
I saw that. And I believe his mother's name was Kathleen. Is that right?
Yeah. Kathleen Maddox.
Yeah. Well, that's my name too. So,
oh, well,
there's too many, there's a lot of things that I was like, I'm feeling uncomfortable now.
So his mom was actually a 16-year-old runaway, and that's who, you know, Charles Manson was born to. Kathleen Maddox. Manson never knew his father. He heard rumors of who his father might be, but he really was only raised with his young mother. Kathleen was abusing alcohol. She was frequently in and out of jail. The people that have commented on Kathleen Maddox that have been interviewed in the past have talked about Kathleen was just kind of she got around town a little bit. So could be a reason why, you know, maybe he didn't know his father or whatnot. But Manson's mother wasn't really that capable of taking care of Charles. Therefore, he was kind of in and out of foster homes and other relatives' homes. And he was a problematic child. At the age of 9, he set fire to his school. So he was kicked out of school, obviously. He was then admitted to a reform school. After that, he spent a little bit more time with his mother. Her various lovers for a period of time would take care of him. And really, Manson only had two male influences, and both were uncles. And they had mixed effects on him. One of his uncles was incredibly religious, and the other uncle was kind of a career criminal. And the one that was the criminal wound up becoming a little bit more of an influence on him going into his young adult years. I'm curious, Dr. Katie, like, tell me about like early family issues. What is already happening to this young boy at 9 years old that's triggering him setting his school on fire? And what's being set into the little kid's mind that's going to go with him as he grows into adulthood?
Yeah, this is really intriguing to think about. I mean, obviously a lot of trauma that we're seeing already, right? So there's a lot of instability in his environment, instability in his emotional care, physical care. It sounds like he was probably neglected, you know, mentally and probably physically. He was seeing a lot of really poor, unhealthy coping skills. And so this is what he was learning. I mean, this is what he was surrounded with, and this is what he became conditioned to use or just learned to use because these are the people that he was around. I mean, that's going to set a child up for failure, so to speak, in a lot of ways, especially if they are coming from a family that may already have biological predispositions to have certain personality traits. And so I always like to think about in cognitive behavioral therapy, there's this, it's called biopsychosocial theory, which is basically how things develop, right? How we develop our personalities, who we are as people. And so I'm thinking about the biological aspects of how he's grown up, the psychological effect of that, and then kind of the environmental social aspects as well. And I think it sounds so far like he had trauma in all of those areas. So it's not necessarily setting him up for a lot of success interpersonally, at least I would say.
I also can't imagine that, you know, in the 50s, late 50s, when this would have been, that the foster care system was probably that great, nor the reform school system. And I imagine that if you have any influence by your peers, there probably isn't the best group of people that are influencing you as a young child there.
Oh yeah. And so that's a good point too, actually. So socially, right? I mean, think about his mother. If people around town knew that she was drinking a lot, especially given the time period and the culture of that period in the U.S., you know, they were probably kind of seen as like bottom of the barrel. Right. Yeah. So if he had to go somewhere, to stay in a foster care or any other kind of facility, I would assume that he was likely also not cared for there.
Yeah. Is there any evidence to support that alcoholic parents, that there may be anything that is hereditary to a child?
Yes, there is. There is a lot of research about the heredity of addiction and, I mean, alcoholism, but really any addiction, substance addiction, so substance use.
You don't hear much about Manson drinking. You just hear really about the use of acid at that time. I would imagine maybe he drank, but it's interesting to think, you know, what maybe that also would have seeded something in him to kind of have a predisposition for drug use.
And I almost wonder, you know, I wish we knew a little more about whether or not his mother drank while she was pregnant with him. I mean, that I'm not saying she was, because I'm not really sure, but I mean, that could possibly have affected him as a person and his development as well. So
under his uncle's influence, he started getting into petty crimes. There are some rumors that maybe even Charles Manson and his uncle actually perpetrated crimes together. It's unclear. But he did first start stealing from homes and stealing cars, and this kind of led to a life of petty crimes. His first armed robbery sent him to a school for boys. At this school for boys, he claimed that he was raped and frequently beaten. He was actually a runaway 18 times from this particular school. His punishments would escalate over time. He went from the National Training School for Boys to a federal reformatory, where he was paroled in 1954, all at the age of 19 years old. So this is still young adult Manson. And Manson would basically be in and out of jail numerous times with short stints in jail here and there. In fact, there's not even enough records out there to show how many times he actually was arrested, but it could have been dozens, if not into the hundreds of times that he was a habitual criminal of typically smaller crimes. But it's interesting because the most of his incarcerations happened in Indiana and Kentucky. And when he did talk about it, he claimed that he was raped and beaten. That particular training school for boys was shut down for those reasons. So let's talk a little bit about now we have, you know, 16 to 19 year old Charles Manson engaging in criminal activity, put in these different types of settings for incarceration. What happens to a young adult male that is raped or beaten? What's now happening? What is the new layer on top of Manson? We know what happened in his young childhood. What's happening with him now?
So, I mean, it's just kind of a repetition of this trauma, right? It's building on this foundational trauma that he's already had and continuing that. And I would think that likely would, it affects your ability to trust other people. And usually your ability to trust yourself, depending on who is committing these rapes or beatings. If it's someone that you thought you could trust, like a family member, a friend, or even someone that as a kid, maybe he thought he went to these schools or reformatories and thought, oh man, finally someone will take care of me, right? I'm just guessing here, but this is a possibility. These people are supposed to be in charge. This is supposed to be a place where I am provided more structure and more care. And then he gets treated, you know, the same or worse. He gets beaten, he gets raped, and then he is even more untrusting of other people. And maybe even his own ability to put trust in somebody in the first place. Another thing that happens, obviously, with any incarceration or long-term hospitalization is this idea of institutionalization. So you get really used to being inside this really small space that's very structured and very kind of cold and clinical. And then you know, it makes it really even that much harder for you to gain social skills that the rest of us are learning out in the world. And we, you know, have much more space and much more movement, social movement between different circles and different kinds of people and all of that. So I would say that all of that probably also was affecting the way that he was thinking about his social interactions and his interpersonal relationships with other people, and definitely had a huge impact on that.
Let's get into the topic of rape for a minute. I'm curious, is rape different between men and women? And the idea of same-sex rape versus opposite-sex rape, are there differences in these types of things? Is it Will a man, this sounds terrible, so is a man going to feel worse being raped by another man versus a woman being raped by a man? Do you understand the difference I'm getting at here? What kind of trauma is that going to have?
Right. I think I understand your question. So obviously all rape is really terrible, very, very terrible. But I see what you're saying. Is there kind of a social propensity because of this idea of masculinity versus femininity, that if you are a man raped by another man, that there's more stigma associated with that. In my experience, that generally seems to be the case. Yes, and a lot more male rape survivors don't come forward because of that. Because there's this idea, right, that you're supposed to be masculine, you're a boy, you're a man, you should be strong, that shouldn't have happened to you. And a lot of people struggle with, well, does that make me gay, even though I didn't like it or didn't want that to happen? So yes, I think definitely because of society and just societal norms with gender that I think hopefully we're moving more towards a change with. But there's been a lot of stigma that goes along with, you know, male to male rape. So I would say, yeah, that's a good point. I think that would also probably factor into this a lot.
Would Charles Manson being raped as a young male, would that affect his influence on his cult later on, when he was more of a domineering person in deciding who would have sex with who and really creating the sex cult part of his overall destructive cult? Is that affecting his decisions when it comes to these relationships with women, or is he is any of this still in him that he wants to be domineering over women in a way? You don't hear about the cult, the females in his cult talking about being raped by Charles Manson. They all willingly wanted to have sex with Charles Manson. But does this factor in? Do these triggers make you a more sexual person later on, or do you overcompensate later on? Does any of that make sense?
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. I'm not sure. I mean, it depends on each person, but I see where you're going with that, as far as maybe like his, potentially the way that he viewed his mother or his relationship with his mother could have affected the way that he sees these women, and the way that he controls them and, you know, uses them to do things for him that maybe, and also this, the idea of being raped and maybe feeling like he has to compensate on some level. I mean, those are all possibilities, definitely.
One thing we haven't mentioned in young Charles Manson's life is his education. And I think seeing the problems that he's been through here and what's happened to him, I can't imagine he had much of an education.
Yes, I would say, I doubt that he, I mean, again, I guess we don't know, but, or I don't know, but based on, you know, the research that we've done and what we've read, I would say it doesn't seem like education was a focus. Yeah. So that probably also had a huge impact, I would think, how he's able to process things, at least.
Right, right. I'm going to touch on a couple other points about Charles Manson, which will kind of bring us up to what people already know with the Manson family cult at Spahn Ranch. So Manson began studying Scientology while incarcerated. So he has a connection not only to the Satanic Church later on, but Scientology was actually before that. So Charles Manson had an involvement with Scientology. In July of 1961, Charles Manson listed his religion as Scientology. A September 1961 prison report argues that Manson appears to have developed a certain amount of insight into his problems through his study of this discipline. I find this really interesting. You never hear anyone talking about Charles Manson studying Scientology. So upon his release...
You do not. Maybe they are to thank for that.
Upon his release in 1967, Manson traveled to Los Angeles, where he reportedly met local Scientologists and attended several parties for movie stars. Manson completed 150 hours of auditing. And for those people who don't know, auditing takes an individual through, this is conducted by members of the Church of Scientology. And what it does is it takes an individual through times in their current and past lives with the purpose of ridding the individual of negative influences from past events or behaviors. So maybe it's possible that Charles Manson was looking to fix himself while being incarcerated, because that happens. People find God in prison. They find philosophies. They become Buddhists. You know, that happens. The hope here is that maybe he was trying to find something more to get out of this, because, you know, he may have been on a 15-year period of time where he's been living a terrible life as a criminal and tired of being incarcerated. So he finds Dianetics or whatever it was that got him interested in this. And he starts this process, and apparently liked it enough to where he wanted to go to the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles and, you know, continue with this practice. I find that very, very fascinating that this is kind of a core for where maybe his philosophies are going to go.
I agree. Actually, it's really interesting when you're talking about auditing and that tie to past events and behaviors. This is a running theme through Manson's life, it seems to me. We'll get to this a little bit later, I think, but even the use of psychedelics, there's a tie in there too, with specifically autobiographical memories and past events, and self-awareness specifically. So this is really interesting to me.
For those people who aren't aware, Scientology is completely against the psychiatric world. They do not believe in psychiatrists. They do not believe in psychologists. They do not believe in any kinds of prescriptions, medications. So in a way, he is seeking a therapy, be it an alternative therapy. So I can't fault him for that, because it seems that he was trying to help himself. And he also wanted to definitely get out of the Midwest, which took him to Los Angeles, which would begin really that next act of his life. And it was at this time that Manson in LA began attracting a group of followers, mostly young women from California. And some of those people would go up to San Francisco with him later. Manson was also preoccupied with becoming a pop star. And from June of 1967 to August of 1968, he had a number of recording sessions, but was not really thought promising enough for a contract. But Manson considered himself a musical genius who would transform mainstream society. So I'm curious. So this is, it's just such an odd footnote.
I know, it just tickles me.
You know, for a cult leader, like this is, so now he's got this infatuation with celebrity and musicians, and obviously LA is working on him. And and I think it's interesting that a person with potentially this low education is considering himself a musical genius who would transform mainstream society. So let's dig into this a little bit, this stuff. Like, could he have been a genius savant if he wasn't very educated? Like, what's,
I mean, maybe. I feel like the chances are very low. I'm gonna guess that I would chalk this up more to this delusional level of grandiosity that he seems to have.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that, and this idea of, you know, wanting to be around famous people and become famous. And it's interesting to me that most of his followers were women, which, again, this is kind of a common theme that we see in a lot of other cults too, but I bet he was a very charming person to talk to. I would say that likely that went along with possibly why a lot of women wanted to spend time with him.
And he probably at 20, 21 years old, 22 years old, he was probably also looking the best he ever looked in his life too.
Yes, I would say so. Usually we are. Although I think I'm getting better with age, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I will say, I want to go back to Scientology for just a moment. Yeah, I've read Dianetics. I'm familiar with Scientology quite a lot. But you know, I don't believe that Scientology is one of those things that appeals to the gullible or the unintelligent. And this is where I really kind of have a little gray area in my thinking about whether Manson may have been smarter than we give him credit for, to be able to orchestrate all of the things he did and to plan things so meticulously, because Dianetics is not an easy read. It really is not. And you have to have some, you would never even continue reading the book or processing any of this information if you weren't smart enough to take it in, because it's so complex that if your neurons aren't firing right, like, you're just not going to get it. You're going to put the book away. And for him to get as far as he did into this, I have to give him a little bit of credit that for him to be able to understand it, he has to be smarter than I think he was.
I agree with that completely. I think that he was fairly smart on a few different levels. And I think it's important to touch on the fact that when we think of intelligence, a lot of times we think of, you know, IQ, what is your IQ number, and intelligence tests and this specific academic version of intelligence, but there are multiple kinds of intelligences. And so I think he just, you know, maybe he didn't go to school. Maybe he wasn't the best at math, for example, but maybe he was really intelligent in other areas of his life in other ways. I mean, I would say for good or bad, obviously bad for him, mostly bad, right? He was at least intelligent enough to manipulate a very large group of people into doing some pretty horrendous things. So I agree with you there.
Thank you for listening to part one of Cult Following the Manson Family. Tune in next week for part two.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Everybody, I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
Hi, I'm Father Daniel DePlantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.